Welcome to the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast, the show where brilliant professionals share how to sharpen the universal skills required to flourish at work, enjoy more career fun, wins, meaning, and money with your host, Pete Lukaitis.
All right. Well, I'm excited for this episode 3 here where we've got Mr. Victor Prince laying down some good perspective when it comes to what he calls strategically managing your leadership capital. And that is the time and energy you invest in people and how to do that in a smart way so that you get the optimal results from all kinds of different folks, whether they're a quote slacker or a quote exemplar. And these terms come from his book. It's award-winning. It's called Lead Inside the Box. And this is a little bit visual, so you might want to go ahead and come on over to awesomeatyourjob.com/EP3, letters EP3, so you can look at that and potentially follow along. But even if you can't do that for a while, it's just fine. You can get the idea auditorily and check it out later. But Victor had some fantastic nuggets to share associated with how not doing this strategic management can even be life-threatening with regard to overwork. Some particular watch-outs, like don't do this, and pro tips, do this if you're interacting with a different particular category of person, and how to have some of those tricky conversations and feedback for when that needs to happen. Victor Prince is the managing director of Discovered Logic, a strategy consulting and training firm that serves clients in the U.S. and overseas. He has over 20 years of experience in corporate and government leadership positions. He was a fellow Bain & Company consultant. There, he led strategy engagements with the clients in the U.S., U.K., France, and Spain. He was an executive at Capital One, where he managed the internet marketing strategy. And as a member of the Washington, D.C. Mayor Fenty's cabinet, he led the CAPSTAT Performance Accountability Program. And as the Chief Operating Officer of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, he helped build a new federal regulatory agency and led a division of over 300 people. So, without further ado, I'll switch it over to Victor. We're here now. Thank you so much for joining us on the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast.
Glad to be here.
Well, I noticed that beyond the bio, you've done a number of cool adventures in terms of different travels and locations, and particularly the Camino recently. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, so I do my adventure travel. I do big hiking and biking trips. And then a couple summers ago, I did the Camino across Spain. So it's about a month long of hiking, about 15 miles a day for 30 days. And it was the best month of my life.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Did you have any, I hear along those journeys, people meet interesting people and it goes into so many kind of unexpected providential kinds of directions.
Yeah, it's been pretty amazing. So you end up making friends, and I've made a bunch of friends from around the world and have been to visit them in England and California and Sweden and elsewhere. So it's pretty amazing the relationships you form on that.
Well, that sounds like a treat. And you've also done a lot of relationship forming in your different roles. And I heard you say leading teams of 3 people to 300 people. You've learned some things and some patterns along the way. Could you share a little bit of kind of the story of how you came to discover some of the key teachings that we find in your book and training?
Sure. It's funny. So when I was doing the Camino, I was taking a sabbatical from my last job as a COO, where I had about 350 people or so. And then as I reflected on my career, I always saw a pattern that there was the input I had to put into folks on my team and then the output I got out of them. And then they started to falling out into a class of 2x2, that there's, you know, some folks you invested a lot of time into and you got a lot out of, and then there's other folks that you invest a lot of time into, get nothing out of. And so it's all about figuring out when you can figure out how they're performing, you can figure out how to get them to a better spot by doing different things and learning from your past experiences.
Excellent. And so you've gone into this 2x2. Can you share a little bit? You've put it out on a leadership matrix, and you've given some additional kind of a particular categories of inputs and outputs. Can you sort of describe a little bit, what do you mean by leadership capital or an input that you put into somebody?
Sure. Well, we first talk about this concept of leadership capital. So just like companies have financial capital to invest, leaders have capital that they have to be very smart about how they invest across their teams. And that the capital is really the time and energy that you've got. So you can spend all your time with folks who need it, or you can become smarter and make sure that you invest it where you're going to get the most return. Because in the short term, you can spend more time at work and you can take on more stress, but over the long term, that doesn't work out. You're going to burn yourself out. So you have to be really smart about how you have the leadership capital that you do have.
Absolutely. And so you actually share a bit of a story that your co-author, Mike, sort of tried to overdo it a little bit and resulted in a heart attack. What's that about?
Yeah, you know, you never want to get a Facebook post from your co-author while you're writing a book that, you know, it's from a hospital gurney. So Mike was really good about, that was one of the really good angles he added to the book, which is this whole idea of it's not just about finding these patterns in folks, but then figuring out how to, we have to manage ourselves as leaders. And this is a way to you know, not necessarily spend more time or energy at work, but just get more out of that. So he added a really good twist on that one.
So when you talk about leadership capital and the inputs, you kind of put those into a number of categories, such as directing, doing, delivering, and developing. I love alliteration, so
yeah.
It's good to remember. And so in practice, like, what is that looking like in terms of the places where lots and lots of time and energy and effort end up flowing?
Yeah, you know, it depends on each with each member of your team. So one of the neat things that we did is, by having that framework on our website for the book, leadinsidethebox.com, we've actually got an online questionnaire that you can fill out. So if you're, you know, if you're saying, hey, here's, I'm going to answer questions about how Victor performs with my team, we go through a pretty simple questionnaire where we ask questions to get a sense of, you know, are you spending too much time kind of answering questions for these folks or taking responsibility to clean up their messes or,
right,
or that, those kind of things. And then you get a result out to say, you know, this person's probably taking a little bit more input from you than on average, and this person in the end needs less, and then we do the same thing with the output as well. So that it's a pretty fun online quiz that we have there that people find pretty useful.
And I like just how simple it was, with like one is yes, zero is no.
Yeah.
And then on the output side of things, I guess it's slightly more complex, a 2-1-0 for high, medium, low. But tell us a bit, you mentioned a few kind of key ways to think about the output side of things with regard to quantity and quality, timeliness and intangibles. Which of those do you think is kind of the hardest to glean or tease out? Because I think in some ways, some of those will probably be leaping to mind quickly and others will be a little trickier to discover.
Absolutely. So when, you know, one of the things to keep in mind as we do this survey and the criteria, that management is not just a computer program. So leadership is an art. So this is a tool to help you get to that. And it's all about directionally putting, you know, differentiating your folks, not necessarily putting them in boxes, but just differentiating. So, you know, on the output side, in some jobs, it's easy to kind of measure quality and quantity of output, right?
Like sales.
Yeah, like sales, for example, it's a great one. In other places, it's not so much. So there, you know, we talk a lot about, it's about the relative scale and differentiating, de-averaging your folks, just to figure out, you know, these two are in a very similar role, maybe making kind of the same about a compensation things, and let's see which one's, you know, above average and which one's below average on this particular criteria. So it's not making it a computer program, but it's kind of applying a little bit of a diagnostic to help you with the art that is leadership.
And so once we sort of know where folks stand, I'd love to get into a little bit of meat here with regard to, so what do I do with different categories of folks? I think in some ways it's sort of tempting. We all want them to be, at least I want people to be, my temptation is, low input, high output kinds of folks, or the two categories,
sure,
you call them, the domain masters and the rising stars. Like, oh yeah, I'd like a lot of those. But in practice, that's not how it always goes. You know, you got a mix. So what do you do once you know where people land and sit?
Yeah. So just first of all, it's a perfect point, which is, if we had the luxury of time and ability to hire our own team, you know, sure, we would get all people that we think are going to be these exemplars. Just, we'd get the all the A players, but that's not the real world.
Right.
So you get the team that you inherit most of the time. So, you know, part of the exercise is figuring out the team you got and then looking at that. So with the folks in that exemplar box, what's interesting, then, they're a gift, right? So these are the folks that are producing the lion's share of your results, and they're not taking any of your time doing it. So that's great to have them, but there's a risk with that as well, which is you can easily take them for granted. So you can either not let them know how much you appreciate the work they're doing, not give them the right rewards, or you can not, or you can try to hold on to them too long. And because if they're just in your, you know, on your team for a while on a very fast career trajectory, they're going to leave your team anyway. If you're not careful, they might leave your team and actually exit your organization, which makes you now look bad for losing one of the rising stars.
Oh, no, that's fantastic. So, well, it's not fantastic to lose a rising star, but a fantastic insight with regard to there could be some risks and temptations in that quadrant. Could you maybe walk us through the other three quadrants? What are some sort of watch outs associated with them?
Yeah. So the other type of folks that are your high output folks, but here's the people that take a lot more of your input to get there. And we call these your high cost producers, right? So just like you have different high cost factories, but they produce great results, take a lot of input to get there. And they come in two flavors. So one is what we call the steamroller. So these are the people who get great results, but they just run over a lot of toes and create a lot of friction on the way to do that.
Yeah.
So the input that you've got to do there is you're always, you know, giving them feedback, fixing the messes they make, apologizing for them. And then with them, you've got to learn how to let them clean up their own messes and not make messes to start with. So that, because if you keep doing that for them, you're actually holding them back from becoming one of those exemplars. Yeah. So that's the steamrollers. And then the other folks are what we call the squeaky wheels. And these are the people that are always in your office, always emailing you, asking you if, you know, hey, should I do this or that? Or I'm about to make this decision. Does that sound all right, boss? And you know, it's really, as a manager, as a leader, it's great to feel useful and to feel smart by helping people out. But you're actually holding them back as well, because you know, if you're always giving them, all right, yep, that's what I would do, then they're not learning. You know, you should try to find places where, you know, it's okay that, you know, as long as they know what the bounds are of their authority, that it's okay for them. You make the decision you make, and then we'll talk about it if you fail. But because the other thing that you find is that people do is a lot of times these squeaky wheels, they're doing it not because they don't know the answer. They either know the answer and don't have confidence, or they know the answer, but they're trying to push off the risk and the responsibility off to their boss, which is if something does go wrong, they're like, well, you told me. It's important to think about that as well. It's great to feel useful, but think about, you know, you might be being counterproductive in the long term.
And along those lines, it seems like there could be gigantic email chains where it's like everybody's included just to do a little bit of the covering of the rearranging. Exactly. Can you confirm? Exactly. Can you also confirm?
Right.
Okay. So that's the high cost producer categories, the steamrollers and the squeaky wheels. How about the detractors? I guess that's the worst of all.
Yeah. So the detractors are, and once again, these boxes aren't good or bad. And the whole exercise here is not about labeling people. It's about saying, here's different in the roles that they're in. Here's kind of their performance pattern and how do we get them to a better spot? Because Mike and I both talk about this in our career. We've been in all of these boxes ourselves, you know, so it's not like if you're a detractor, you're always a bad person or anything like that. But so in the detractor box, these are the folks that you spend a lot of time with as the leader. So you're fixing their problems. You're giving them advice and all that, more than average, more than you really should be doing, but you're not getting results out of them that are in line with the input you've got out of them. So you've got to fix that pretty quickly, because it's going to do two things. So one is, if they don't get into a better spot professionally, they're probably one layoff away or something like that from being in a really bad spot. So you've got to make it very clear to them how their, the situation is not good for them professionally. And here's how, we got to fix this ASAP, and here's how we need to fix this. So just for them, it's important, but for you as well, but then more importantly for your team in general, if you let detractors kind of just stay in that bad box, everyone else on the team knows, where you're the people who are just in the wrong jobs or the people who are just aren't trying. They see that, and they know that every day that you're not fixing that, the rest of the team is looking at you as the boss and saying, you're not doing your job, so why should I do mine? I'm tired of carrying the weight for the folks there just because you're not addressing the problems.
Oh, that is a fantastic frame there. It's in their own best interest because their career is at risk for what could happen.
Yeah.
It's in the overall team's best interest because they're watching, they're noting it. So I think that's a fantastic perspective. And do you have any best practices for how you go about delivering some of that difficult feedback along the way?
Yeah, because there's two different types. There's the square pegs. So these are the folks that are just in the wrong job, right? So maybe they got promoted too early. Maybe they got reorganized into something that they just aren't there. So with them, it's just sitting down and saying, hey, here's your job description and here's, what you need to do. And here's, let's find the capability gaps because, if you've got some gaps here, let's quickly figure that out. Figure out where you can get some training or some experience. And then, let's get going with that. So it's with them, it's all about finding what gaps they have. And then with the other type, which is they've got the skills to do the job, but they just don't have the will. So these are what we call your slackers. So them, it's sitting with them to figure out, hey, why aren't you getting this done? Is it motivation? Is there, is someone stealing the credit for your work? Is it, is this not the job that you want? You just don't understand that, you're getting paid. You kind of have to work. You figure out what the motivation is. And if you can unlock that, the great thing about slackers is that if you can unlock that motivation, they're talented people and they can do great, which would be great for you as a team and be great for them professionally. Cause then they could, your slackers could easily be your exemplars if they just get that right motivation unlocked.
All right. And how about the final quadrant, the passengers?
Yeah, the passengers are in some ways one of the more interesting ones, because these are the folks where they don't take a lot of your time. So they're not creating problems and that type of thing, but they're also not providing the output that they should. And even though they're not creating problems that you have to deal with, you know, very clearly, they are creating a lot of problems that you're not dealing with. And these come in two flavors. So one is what we call the joyriders. And these are the people who come to work with a lot of energy. They love being at work. They love the social aspect and all that. And they're always busy, but they're just not doing the job that they're supposed to do. Mm. And then for them, it's the challenge is, because they're not doing the job they're supposed to do, someone else is picking that up. So their colleagues are doing their work for them. And because in some ways they're like, well, it's just easier for me to do it than try to redirect them. But at the same time, their colleagues, you know, it is costing you because you as the boss aren't redirecting them. So the colleagues are mad because they're having to do their work. And then you're also disserving that person themselves, because that person has a lot of great energy. And if you can just focus them on the job that they're paid to do, they could do very well. So it's your job as a boss to turn them around for your team and for themselves. And then the other type is the stowaway, which is, these are the folks, you know, that just, they're coming in and they're just trying to get a paycheck and do as little work as possible. And they've gotten very good about being very slippery, trying to get and hold them to work, which it's easy. In some ways, it's easier for you as the boss just to not engage them. But once again, everyone on the team knows exactly who's not pulling their weight, and their morale is down if the boss isn't addressing that, because that person's taken up a very valuable slot on the team.
Well, and it sounds like the stowaways may be the toughest to, you probably don't want to use the word fix, but upgrade, elevate.
The key with them is just to engage them, which is like they become masters at just staying in the shadows and you know, showing up and not getting fired, not getting in trouble, not getting fired, but you know, just getting there and having a job. And you just really got to engage them, say, hey, listen, you know, the gig's up, that, you know,
I see you.
Yeah. Here's the job description you have. And here's, you know, other people have that same one. And here's, you know, you make it, it's not personal. You just say, here's what your job description is. And here's what everyone else is producing. Here's where you are. Let's work through why this is happening. Is it, do you need some training? Do you need, you know, am I not giving you something you need? So you get them to, you know, you figure out with them what the engagement is. And if it's just that they're not interested in the job, then help them find another job. If it's that, you know, you're doing something to demotivate them, figure that out. But you just have to engage them. Just, you know, spend that time. And because as a manager, as a leader, it's really easy. If someone's not demanding your time, you love it if you can save time and not have to, you know, have that half hour meeting or whatever. Yeah. But some cases you really need to insist on it.
Oh, that's good stuff. And you also mentioned in this world of sort of leadership temptations is that when it comes to the performance review time, you may have some temptations to give people, for example, the squeaky wheels, maybe a lower mark in some places, but be like, that's what you think is deserved. But, you know, maybe you're like, oh, I don't want to deal with a headache associated with that. What are some other kind of risks or temptations that appear during performance review time?
Well, you know, I think just there's three temptations that I think people, managers have that one of the reasons why we wrote the book, which is, you know, people either managers go through what we call the path of least resistance, which is, you know, I want to work with the people that are easier to work with, more fun to work with, and I'm gonna spend all my time and energy there. And so they go down that path. And so another one is everyone thinks that some managers think they've just got to spend, you know, the same amount of time and energy with everyone. We call that the peanut butter approach, which is, you know, if your CFO invested your company's money that way, you probably wouldn't be very happy.
Oh no.
And then the third one is just being reactionary. So whoever, you know, is knocking on your door, or whoever's the squeakiest wheel, you're always spending the time and energy with. So as leaders, that's part of what we have to do, whether it's performance reviews or whether it's just how you spend all your time and energy every day. It's being smart about how you invest your time and where you want to invest the energy that you have to give feedback, to engage people, and that type of thing.
Perfect. Well, so now having gotten a bit of a sense for what the model is and how the matrix works, could you maybe share with us a success story or a case study or just how that ended up making a real positive impact in practice with real people?
Yeah, you know, once again, I'll talk. So I've been in most of these boxes, and between Mike and I, we've been in all these boxes. So it's in some ways it's easier to tell a personal story.
Sure.
So you know, we disguise the stories are composites and that kind of stuff. But
sure.
So in one of the stories in the book is a pretty thinly veiled composite because the name is Mikhail. So you can figure out which one of those is us. But it talks about, you know, there's a project where a young consultant, you know, has been getting great reviews, comes on a new project, and then, you know, does kind of what they think is a pretty slick presentation that's pretty edgy and cutting edge because it's, the latest technology and all the stuff that's going on the internet, but then the client doesn't like it and says it's just the latest thing that, they could have read from one of the internet sites or something. So, it demotivates the guy, he checks out. And then the so what of that is the manager engages in that. And it's not just about giving someone feedback and saying, this performance is not going to serve you well. It's not going to serve your client well. It's not going to serve us well. But then what the manager did also said, you know what? I owe this to you. So I'm going to make sure that I manage you for the next several projects until you turn this around. Because one of the things that's so easy to do in today's world as a leader is, you get someone on your team who's not doing a great job, but you're like, either she's going to move on in 6 months or I'll move on in 10 months to a new job. So I'll just let the next person do it. And that's one of the biggest failures and of a weak leader is just to kind of wait things out and not address a problem like that. So in that case, it was a good example of the manager not just giving the feedback, but then saying, you know what, I'm going to take you on my team until we either fix this or we figure something else out.
That is great. And it seems kind of heroic, really. It's like that is a degree of self-sacrifice, but it is in the interest of the employee, the team, the company, and sort of all those folks that individual will touch professionally over the decades to come.
Yeah, because it's really about thinking about your role as a team leader in different ways, which is you've got bets to place, right? So you've only got so many hours and so much energy in a week to spend. So you want to place your bets on different parts. And in this case, that leader said, you know what? It's going to cause me stress and more work, but I think it's the right thing for the company to help you get through this. I think it's the right thing for you. I owe it to you as not just your boss, but as kind of a career coach. It's one of the roles that you have as a leader. So it's worked for me, but I'm going to spend more than my average number of chips on you just because it's the right thing to do. And that's where being smarter and not just working harder as a leader is important.
Perfect. Thank you. Well, before I shift gears to the rapid fire fast faves section, is there anything else that we should talk about with regard to Lead Inside the Box or the Leadership Matrix before moving on? I just want to make sure if you've got a golden nugget that I don't skip past it.
Well, I guess the great thing is that one of the biggest insights we get from readers is as soon as people see the framework, they go, aha, that's Victor or that's Joanne, or they immediately see the pattern. And the point of the book, once again, it's not about putting people in boxes. It's about seeing these patterns, because once you identify a pattern someone is in, you can more quickly and come up with a better strategy to help them get to a better place by just understanding how these patterns fall out and different examples from the past. So that's one of the biggest ahas we get, is that just by having the framework, people, it's just unlocking knowledge that they've already had, but it helps them draw on it quicker.
That's been my experience with, I think, any good framework. That's kind of what it should do. It liberates that, and now we know it, and we can move on quickly. Once you give a bit of a vocabulary to that, whether it's like sounds like the Myers-Briggs, or sounds like a leadership matrix, or sounds like any number of 2x2s we've had the pleasure of making for our clients in consulting.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, if that covers that, I'd love to move into the fast faves. Could you start off by sharing with us what's a favorite quote you have, something that you find inspiring or rejuvenating again and again?
I'm a big John Lennon fan. So I usually use the quote, I'm not sure the exact words, but life is what happens while you're making other plans. And what I like about that quote is he wrote that in a solo album in 1980, and he died. He got killed just a month later. So it's just a great story that particularly as people who are early in our careers or others, that we've got all these grandiose plans about where we want to go or where we want to be in 20 years. But, we can spend all our time thinking about, the path to get there. We have to realize that every day we're living it. So it's just a good reminder that in our careers or in our life, that just enjoy every day and make every day count.
Mm-hmm. And how about a favorite study or a piece of experimentation or research you find yourself thinking about or citing often?
Yeah. So one thing that always got me is I got jobs with bigger and bigger responsibility and more and more authority, particularly when I worked in the government where you've got some legal authority as well.
Oh, yeah.
I always thought about the huge responsibility that you've got that goes along with that authority, and that test about the people who are told they're delivering shocks to the students and then they hear the screams.
Oh, Stanley Milgram.
Yeah, I forget the name of it, but that one always reminds me that you've got to be careful because you forget it. Like if you're a COO, I'm just Victor, but when you're talking to other people, they see a lot of authority. And if you just make offhanded remarks or you ask them to do things, they're going to assume that, that you've thought about it and they're going to do it just because you say so, not because, that you're suggesting it. So that's one thing to think about as your career, as you get more authority, just think about that. Are you doing? It's not just think about it. People view you with authority, and you got to make sure that you're doing things that are always right. Because mm-hmm. people will do, even if you make mistakes, people will follow you just because you're in authority sometimes.
Yeah. And how about a favorite book, something that you found incredibly useful in your own career development?
Yeah, you know, so I love nonfiction books, and there's a lot of good ones out there. But for fun, I read historical fiction. And one of the historical fiction books I read that had a good effect on me in my career is Ken Follett's The Pillars of the Earth. And the reason it's this historical fiction that goes on over generations in England, and it's about a family and a guy who builds a cathedral. And then so what I got out of that for my career was that people would build these cathedrals, but it takes 100 years back then to build a cathedral. So, you know, in 20 years, you know, you may not live to see the end of your work, but you left a mark, right? So the people who did the facades and the churches or others, they put all that craftsmanship in because they wanted to leave results of the work that they'd done even long after they left that, you know, in that case, their lives. But so I've always taken that as I always think about the results and the impact I'm leaving in a job that I have, or, you know, what's going to be there in 10 years or 20 years, not just, you know, am I going to get a good review this year?
Oh, that's powerful. Thank you. How about a favorite website or online resource that's been useful to you?
You know, so I'll have to admit my guilty pleasure in the football season is all the fantasy football podcasts. I love the strategy and all that. But, you know, one I love just I use as a resource more is I love Snopes.com because it's the one that goes out. And whenever you hear a rumor online, it's the one that kind of does research and either says if it's true or not, or, you know, if it's partly true or not. So I love that site because it's not really partisan or political. It's just, you know, it gets at, because a lot of times as a leader, where I bring that back as a leader, when you hear good news, you know, particularly about something that's going on in your team or a strategy that you had that's working, you want to kind of believe the good news. Snopes is just a good example of always, you know, get the data. Always go for data. Don't just like hear what you want to hear. Figure out whether it's true or not.
Oh, my buddy Brent loves that one. It's fun. How about a favorite habit, a personal practice of yours that has been pretty instrumental in helping you get where you've gotten?
Yeah, you know, I'm starting more of a writing career now. So one of the things I do is I try to write something 5 days a week, right? So what writers write is the saying that goes, and you can think about things all day, but until you start putting pen on paper or you know, putting pixels on the screen, what's in your head doesn't exist until you start writing. So, you know, even if it's 50 words or a small thing, I just try to do something every day in a little way just to get the well flowing. So that, I think that applies to anything. So my goal is, you know, to have a book a year kind of thing. So I'm just going to take one day at a time and do a little bit of writing.
Catching you at the early stages then.
Yeah. My next one actually I'm working on is going to be a little bit about the Camino that we talked about.
Oh, that's great.
I think so.
How about any favorite tools with regard to whether it's gadgets or software or devices or thought frameworks that you find useful?
Yeah, I'm a big 2x2 guy, obviously. That's what my first book is built around that. So I always love you find two things that, you know, that you can really de-average the world against and give you a useful way to figure out. So 2x2 is a great framework, but then, you know, technology wise, like I love my iPad because I pair it up with keyboard, and then it helps me in the goal I had last time about writing every day. So I tuck that thing, you know, I don't have to carry a briefcase. I'll tuck my iPad in the small of my back and take it out wherever I go. So if I'm at a restaurant and I get a good idea about a blog post I want to do, I just start writing. So having something very wearable, you know, that you can just work on wherever you are is kind of a good trick that I found.
Speaking of tricks, any time-saving approaches that you like to employ?
The multitasking is one, so, you know, but it's a double-edged sword. So I love to do two things at once, but then, you know, the downside with that is it can be distracting. So getting low tech helps me out. So every day I just start with one piece of paper and I write down, here's the five things I know I want to get done today, you know, and then I get low tech and simple, and that helps keep me from getting too ADD from multitasking.
And how about a favorite sort of a nugget of wisdom or truth bomb? I've noticed that with a lot of folks who write books or speak, like they know there's a little something that when you say it, the head start nodding, the pen start clicking for the note taking on Twitter, it gets retweeted. What's that for you?
You know, I did a blog that was pretty popular, particularly with folks. It was basically because I get a lot of questions from people, particularly in their 20s or starting their career, about advice I have. And I said, you know what? So I'm going to write a letter back to my 45-year-old self. I'll write a letter back to my 25-year-old self. And the biggest thing I had in that was, you know, don't just get ready. Don't think about what the ideal career you have. You're going to have several. So I've had, I think I'm on career number 7 now. And the point is, keep trying things until you find something that you love to do, that you're good at, and someone will pay you enough, right? And if you can find the job where you can answer those three questions in the way that you need to, that's where you find happiness and success, and you get the right balance. And, you know, don't just do what you think you should be doing. If you can find the job that you love, you're good at, and someone will pay you enough to do, then you've kind of figured it out.
Oh, that's good. I was just talking about Breaking Bad, Walter White. I don't know if you saw the series.
Yeah, I love that series. I wouldn't recommend that as a career track.
No. But that's kind of, he said something similar about this that path. But and how about, it's probably not Walter White, but a favorite a role model, you know, someone that you look up to professionally, and why that is.
So it was kind of neat when I went to Wharton, and then I used to get the Wharton magazine, and there was an alumni in there who was a bunch of years ahead of me that was doing some stuff I really thought was neat. I was living in D.C., and he was working in D.C. He ran the metro system in D.C. Then he went off to be the city administrator, which is kind of like the deputy mayor. And then he went off to Treasury and then other places. Always like, that's kind of neat, because he was in public service doing kind of MBA, really cool level stuff. And then so I thought it'd be fun to meet him. And I ended up not only meeting him, I ended up working with him in D.C. And he became a little bit of my mentor. And but his name, Dan Tangerlini. So he was his last big job, he was the head of GSA. Which was President Obama asked him to go in and turn around the GSA after a pretty big scandal that they had a few years ago. So if you ever see the name Dan Tangerlini, Tangerlini, he's a really interesting guy, really innovative.
And what about a favorite way to find you? If folks want to learn more or get in touch with you, is email or Twitter or website? What's the best path?
Yeah, probably the best. I've got a lot of websites. Probably the simplest one is just my name, so victorprince.com. And there's it's kind of a switchboard to all the other sites that I have. So just victorprince.com. And then, you know, my book's on Amazon and all the usual places. And then it's about to start being in all the FedEx office stores as well, which is, there's like a couple thousand of those across the U.S. And it's in most airport bookstores, the Hudson bookstores. So
that's great.
A lot of places to find me. So
those are dream distribution channels. There's not space for a ton of books at the FedEx, but you're in.
So look me up at victorprince.com, and I love engaging with folks who read my stuff or other things. So
will do.
Love to hear from your audience.
Oh, thank you. And as a parting thought, do you have maybe a favorite challenge or call to action that you'd like to leave folks with?
It's don't just do well, do good, right? So a lot of folks, because I was on the fast track, Wharton MBA, a lot of my classmates went out and done extremely well, but there's so much that people, that leaders and others who got that kind of education can do, that it's not just about making money, but helping the world out. And I don't mean in small things. Just pick something where you can, if you spend 10% of someone who's got an MBA or is a really smart leader at work, just applying a little bit of that in the nonprofit space or others has such leverage. So think about that as you get more experience in your career. Think about where you can make a small investment that has huge dividends in a place like that.
Oh, perfect. Well, Victor, thanks so much. This has been a real treat to have you on the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast. I wish you the best of luck in continuing to make a positive difference in all the ways you do here.
Glad to help out, Pete. Anytime.
So that's Victor's perspective there. If you want to check out that matrix and see what that is visually and access some of the things mentioned in a handy link format, just come on down to awesomeatyourjob.com/EP3, letters EP, then the number 3. And look forward to catching you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode. To get the most out of this conversation, visit awesomeatyourjob.com to find today's show notes, transcript, and infographic summary cheat sheet. For more entertaining professional skill sharpening, be sure to subscribe to catch the next episode of How to Be Awesome at Your Job.